The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, an award winner at Global Finance. The Innovators 2021, that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Well, I never had the privilege of meeting Shalene Surtee Richards, but I do have this huge sense of regret that we didn't get her on. And I blame my producers to other people's money. I think she would have been a wonderful, larger-than-life guest and would have taught us so much about a life in acting and a life really was celebrating today in terms of her remarkable contribution to stage and screen in South Africa. What a pity that we didn't get her onto The Money Show. But we will have this evening Rocco de Villiers, who is a pianist, a composer. He's a music director. He is very, very active in the world of music. He will be our Other People's Money guest later on. Kim Potgieter, certified financial planner and author of a brand new book called Midlife Money Makeover. We'll pick up with that. We'll talk to the CEO of Tungela Resources, which had a rough start on the JSE today. Polly van Wyk, all about the Shivambus and some of the money that went into Brian Shivambu's account is finding its way back to VBS, or at least to the liquidators. We'll talk about today's markets. And in a moment, from Kooki Kooiman, Executive Director and Portfolio Manager, Denker Capital, while as we go into yet another week of load shedding, it shouldn't all be doom and gloom, believe it or not. We'll pick up on that in a moment.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, the lights went out here in Sandton tonight just before we came on air, and was a reminder of just the vulnerability of the economy to the vagaries of Eskom, which somehow, by a wing and a prayer and some nifty patching skills, is keeping most of the power on most of the time. But the grid does feel incredibly vulnerable and increasingly rickety. While we wallow in understandable self-pity, because it's deeply infuriating, something else is also happening, and that is trading updates coming out of South African banks hint that the economy may actually be recovering better than expected. It came through in First Rand's trading update today. Kooki Kooiman at Denker Capital. Evening, Kooki. I know you've been part of the afternoon call that the bank has had with its investors today. How cautiously optimistic, upbeat, nervous are they about this about this environment? This trading statement seemed quite optimistic with some caveats.
Yeah, no, Bruce, the trading statement was showed that the full year results will be much better than anticipated 6 months ago or when they had the previous update. But you know, for that one, must also go back to the same period last year, in other words, the second half of last year, when First Rand specifically made a massive provision for potential bad debts and loan growth was under pressure. So coming off that low base and very high provisions, yeah, it looks like earnings per share for the full year could be 35% up. But in terms of your comments, management were actually trying to still temper expectations down. Alan Pullinger was trying to be, in your words, cautiously optimistic. And the main phrase used was, yeah, this is just a rebound, a cyclical rebound from a low base, not a structural growth phase yet. And for that, we've got, you know, at the moment, Eskom to thank that, yeah, South Africa is still one of the lower growing countries in 2021 and will be in 2022. Most other emerging markets and developed markets will show much stronger growth than we do. And so the three things that are hampering us is obviously Eskom, insufficient electricity. Secondly, lack of a good plan from government. And then the high debt levels we started off with. But if you go back to the result is actually, it's not a result, it's an update. But it shows that the economy is doing better than we all anticipated. And a lot of it has to do with factors outside of South Africa. Very strong commodity prices, which is helping us to show a strong trade balance, and which keeps the rand strong, but also agriculture. And then slowly, as Tourist Rand Management said, you can see that demand for mortgages is picking up. I think we can see that everywhere in house prices starting to recover. Consumers are starting to spend again, but he says still cautious.
It's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, I just recall we had a discussion with Khari Fareed, the chief executive at Capitec, in April when they came out with their results. Just have a listen to his experience, and then let's compare the Capitec experience with that of First Rands.
I think it's the story of two halves. I think the first half was focusing on COVID, trying to understand COVID, making certain that our clients are supported, making certain that our staff is safe, and then actually working from home. That was a new experience. And I still remember from July, we actually deliberately said at our EXCO meetings, we need to focus on growth. We need to focus on providing new products to our clients, and we need to make certain that our client experience are 100%. And I think that's what we managed to do. You know, we've launched 6-7 new products. And basically from July on, our branches was operating at 100% capacity. And we've managed to start getting a balance between working from home and working from office. So I think overall we had a good year.
And that's the point, is that things are improving better than expected. And that may be the cyclical recovery rather than a structural recovery. But one gets a sense from these banks that the bad debts, the massive bad debts, which they had provisioned for, the fact that the Reserve Bank gave them an instruction not to pay a dividend last year, all of that was hyper-conservative, Cookie. And that's all well and good, but the really catastrophic fallout that we may have feared in April, May last year hasn't played out in the same way that it had. The lack of recovery is frustrating, but it's not all fall down.
No, you're quite right. And that call was actually quite good in the sense that it also showed, and that's throughout South Africa, not only financial services companies, although in terms of digitalization strategies as we speak, you know, they've been at the forefront, but South African managements have reacted, and specifically banks as well have launched new products that cater for faster communication, better communication, better client service, and work from home has facilitated that, and also the fact that clients couldn't come to branches or didn't want to go to branches. So I think we mustn't underestimate the effect that has on the economy as well, that managements have still been growing the business and doing a lot of things that will put them on a better and a stronger foot going forward. But you're quite right. For our economy to do better, we actually really need government to almost have an ideological mind shift. They've got to allow the private sector, to create jobs and not to interfere too much.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's the dream. We live the dream. We hope that realization dawns sooner rather than later. I mean, your outlook for the banks, considering that they are something of a proxy for the economy, that there is life in the mortgage market, that there is life in the micro-lending market. Is it too small to have too big an impact? If, suddenly commodity prices start to come under pressure and we start losing the benefit of the trade balance, the wheels come off quite quickly. We need some real economic activity in here if we're going to sustain a recovery.
Yeah. Look, by the way, what's happening here is the same globally. So globally, we're seeing the same. Huge provisions made on the banking side, insurance side as well. They were all, in the end, proven to be too cautious, and those reserves are being released. In the US, UK, more also because of the government aid programs, which we didn't have here. But the question everywhere is, what will happen when the aid programs end? Now, when Biden's incentive packages or help packages or checks that go to the consumer, when that ends, similarly in the UK. So here as well, obviously we didn't have the aid coming through. So what will happen in South Africa when commodity prices start falling over, when they start, normalizing, they are too high, when they start coming down a bit, will that cause corporate loan growth? And that is really the US, UK, Europe, South Africa, we hear the same. We're not really seeing the large companies creating new jobs. A lot of the jobs being created is, let's say, McDonald's, restaurants, where consumer spending is picking up. And so those jobs, those people that were laid off, are being hired again. But in South Africa as well, we need the corporates to start investing capital. And for that, I think it's very important that, that government gives the direction as well. But in terms of our own view, I think we are the view that South Africa will do better even now still than we expected. There are a lot of things starting to move in the right direction. And then our market is still, because it was sold off so much, it is still actually good value. And the banks as well, not bad value, not as good. They've actually done fairly well. But the price to books, are still, ABSA is still trading below book value. Netcore is still trading at 0.83 book value. The average over the previous 10 years has been 1.8. Now, okay, we won't grow as strongly, won't do as well as we did, but I think maybe we're all a bit too pessimistic.
Thank you, Corky Koyman, Executive Director and Portfolio Manager at Denker Capital this evening.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
And coming up at about 7 this evening, the pianist behind this little ditty is Rocco de Villiers. He'll be joining us live 7 this evening. This is him playing a piano in the felt. I don't know how he did it, but hey, it sounds nice. Rocco de Villiers, Other People's Money, coming up at 7.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Beat that, Siboniso Ngomalo, Portfolio Manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group. All you do is talk about markets. I want you to be tinkling ivories. I want you to be playing music. I want you to be putting markets to music because they needed music today. There was not much joy, I'm afraid, anywhere except bizarrely in Rand Head shares. We saw today AB InBev and British American Tobacco and Richemont all performing strongly in this weirdly strong Rand environment.
Yes, Bruce. I mean, those companies, I mean, except for Richemont, Richemont has been strong. I mean, actually, one of the strangest things we've seen with COVID is that the wealthy, obviously, with the recovery in the markets, have become wealthier, and they've gone out there and they've spent, especially in jewelry. And so Richemont completely blew the market apart, I think, a couple of weeks ago when they reported their numbers. So their rally is understandable. Anheuser, biggest beer company in the world, and with the Northern Hemisphere and the developed world reopening, again, we should start seeing that company as people start going out to pubs and enjoying themselves as they get vaccinated. So, I mean, we're expecting a recovery. British American Tobacco has been very disappointing. And so, again, the fundamentals of that company should still be intact. And so, again, that doesn't surprise us too much. But, Bruce, the thing that was interesting today was in the financial space, First Rand, which is the owner of FNB, West Bank, RMB, and Ashburton, they came out with a trading statement. Their year ends now in June, and it's a bank. And so, therefore, they can give us some insight into the country. One of the things they said was, like, well, they're feeling a lot better about the outlook. And their earnings are going to recover faster than the market was expecting.
Now, we've just been chatting to Corky Koyman at Denker Capital all about this. And yeah. I mean, his final sort of comment was, perhaps we've all been just a little bit too negative. And, well, you've just got to look at the performance of the stock market over the last 12 months to know he's absolutely right. I mean, from your perspective, the outlook that they are painting, how optimistic is it?
Well, they're saying about South Africa, they're saying, well, economic rebound is faster than initially expected, combined with ongoing strong collections. So people are paying back their loans faster than anticipated. They're saying that the bad debts are less than they'd predicted, and the arrears. So the money that people obviously had not been able to pay last year through the lockdowns, actually that's reducing much, much quicker than they thought. So, I mean, saying, yes, it's still tough, but actually, hey, wait a minute, things are a little bit better. than what they're expected. And so that says something positive about the country. So I think Corky is onto something there.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we'll get the GDP numbers, official GDP numbers coming out tomorrow. I'm curious as to where we are seeing real growth. We know that it's going to come in the resources sector. We know it's going to come in agriculture, particularly in citrus and other exports, for example, because that's what's keeping our balance of payments as buoyant as it is at the moment. Explain to me, please, what happened today with the listing of Anglo-American's old coal business. There's a new vehicle called Thungela Resources. It came to the market at 25 Rand and then didn't see that price again all day.
Bruce, it was never going to see that price again. I mean, Anglo-American has these old coal assets that it's held for a very long period of time. And as you know, in today's world, the idea of coal or dirty energy or carbon-filled energy, that's it's almost like a swear word. Nobody likes this stuff. And so Anglo-American, it's called a demerger, where if you owned a share, for every 10-year shares of Anglo-American that you hold, you get one share of this together. Now, the trick here is that 70% of the holders of Anglo-American are actually foreigners. So first of all, Thungela is obviously a coal business. It's rather small, and it's a South African asset. So all these global players are looking at this and they're actually just selling it. And that's, we saw high volumes and we saw the price coming down. And also, this is actually quite a short life asset. If you look at it, the mines generally have a life of between 6 and 11 years, unless management goes and spends money. But in that assumption, that means this business 11 years from now will close its doors. And so therefore, again, in looking at that, you've got to say, hey, okay, so what are we buying here? Well, you're buying a coal business which supplies coal, thermal coal, to Eskom and other industrial producers in South Africa and industrial companies, but also it exports. And coal prices at this moment are actually rather high. And so, therefore, when we calculate it internally, we say, well, over the next 4 or 5 years, if you hold this asset, you should be able to get today's current valuation back in dividends. And so, hey, Bruce, there could be an opportunity here.
No, that's so interesting because, I mean, I look at coal, and I don't know if you've ever played a game called Pass the Parcel. It's where you put a prize in the middle of newspaper and you wrap it up and you pass it around the room. And then when the music stops, you unwrap a level of the paper and maybe a cockroach falls out or whatever. But I've always seen coal as a bit of a hand grenade in the middle of a Pass the Parcel. And if you're the last person holding the parcel, this thing could explode in your hands. You're suggesting, actually, there's a strong economic case to be made here to own this thing.
Everything has a price, Bruce. I mean, I think in the market, that's what the essence of markets are. Markets look in the future and they say, well, what am I going to get for this particular? So, yes, you are passing the parcel. But first of all, I think one thing we've got to acknowledge is that globally, coal is still required to produce energy. I mean, even in South Africa, we've recently built 2 power stations, Kusile and Medupi. Now, they might not work as well as
exactly,
we want them to,
yes.
But they're going to be around for the next 40 years, Bruce, and they're going to use coal for the next 40 years. Globally, it's the same, especially in these emerging economies. And so, therefore, these assets have a right to exist because they power the world. And so, for us, again, if we look at it, we're saying, yes, you are passing the parcel around. But if you're getting paid to pass that parcel around, hey, that could be worth something.
Sibonise Nkumalo, thank you. Portfolio manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group. Thank you. We'll talk to the chief executive of Thungela Resources later on. Julian Glovu, chief executive at Thungela, will join us just after Eyewitness News at 7 o'clock this evening. There's a short-selling company which is saying that Thungela is actually worth zero because the cleanup of the mess that coal mines leave behind is considerably higher than has been reported so far. So we'll put that to Julian Glovu this evening, coming up here on The Money Show. Need to level up your triple BEE score before the financial year end? Well, the Employment Youth Service can help boost your business's triple BEE level almost immediately. Partner with YES and they'll place young job seekers in your company, giving them vital first-hand work experience. And that first job, the critical first job, while your business benefits by gaining up to 2 levels on its triple BEE scorecard. Say yes to reigniting the economy. Visit yesforyouth.co.za to register. That's yes, the number 4, youth.co.za.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Matching foresight with sustainable possibilities to unlock your business's potential. APSA Insights is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking on 702 in Cape Talk. Now, you don't just need data to keep track of trends that are shaping the economy. You need the expertise to turn that data into valuable insights and sustainable growth opportunities that will unlock your business's potential. In the coming weeks, the next APSA Insights series for 2021, I will be talking to the bank's experts about investment possibilities in key sectors driving not only the South African economy, but the African economy. This month, we're focusing on the huge growth opportunities in agriculture. While production might be booming, a lot of infrastructure needed to support this growth in industry is not growing. But that's where there's been stability and regulation and incentives, and there are countries that are benefiting. So for APSA Insights, I chatted to Wandile Sihlobo, the Chief Economist at Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa, who is also on the Presidential Advisory Board on Land, and I asked him about the evolution of our policy around redistribution.
I mean, if you look back 1994 up until today, some of the mistakes we have made, again, on particularly on a redistribution side, is that we had favored people who had more political connections, rich black men. And I mean, I'm not just making up those statements. The work by Tembega Kepe and Ruth Hall published a paper which pretty much showed that research. Now, it's about how do you correct those measures and really make sure that their story about land reform, it's not only just about the restorative justice question only. We are sitting in a slow growth slump. You are addressing two goals, economic growth and job creation, and also restorative justice. Then how do you balance those two pillars in your quest for progress? And I think that's the difficult things for policymakers.
It's difficult, but it's not impossible, is it? I mean, you've sat on the Presidential Advisory Board on land with a bunch of other very, very clever people. Are you stuck, or do you think you've got a path?
No, I think there is a path for 100%, but it's about then the political will following through that. Because obviously, when you're sitting in advisory positions, you do write some of these things. You don't know what your what political imperatives your principal do face. But I do think that it's about time now we move through that. I mean, it's the same discussion when you're looking at the former homelands areas. Some of us are from those areas. We've grew up from those areas looking that way, and we haven't seen much economic activity. It's about now to say, okay, let's look in these areas in line with some of the government land. What changes can we make on the land governance? And we've made those submissions. And I think it's about time to put test cases and realize that it's about time to see progress and some economic activity in all of these areas.
Wandile Sihlobo, the economist, talking to me all about agriculture, talking to me all about land reform. You can get the full chat with Wandile and the other guests in the APSA Insight series on your favorite podcast app or on the station's website. Just look for the feature APSA Insights all this month about agriculture.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking. This year's winners of Global Finance, Most Innovative Bank in Africa, the Innovators Awards 2021. That's Africanacity. APSA's a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. And coming up on the next Money Show, the Deputy Chairman of Sasfin Securities, David Shapiro, is Headmaster of the Investment School. He's going to share with us 10 simple rules. He promises they're simple to follow if you want to be successful in the stock market. We'll also do our Africa Business Report and our regular visit to the world of advertising with Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros. That's all coming up next time on The Money Show.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, the EFF deputy leader Floyd Chivambu's brother Brian admitted receiving money for no good reason from VBS Mutual Bank, and according to Daily Maverick, has agreed to pay at least some of it back. Uncovering the story, as she always does, is Polly van Wyk, who is a journalist with Scorpio at Daily Maverick. And it confirms, Polly, what you've been reporting on for what, years now. This is effectively an admission of guilt.
Hello, Bruce. Yes, indeed. So he signed an acknowledgement of debt, and his lawyers demanded a confidentiality clause to keep it away from all of us, demanding some sort of truth and accountability. And he acknowledged that he would have to pay back 4.55 million rand. And the reason for that is there were no underlying reason for receiving the money in the first place.
4.455 million looks like about a quarter of what you've reported ended up flowing through his account, though.
Yeah, indeed. So we found around 20 million rand in terms of loans as well as cash flowing from various BBS linked companies right up through to Schameka Projects, which is Brian Shibambu's company. From here on, we discussed before you and I that it left the company and flowed into two front companies named Grand Azania and Mahuna Investments, which I found when I looked at who the beneficiaries of the money were. It is Julius Malema and Floyd Chibanga's front companies. And from that, they funded their Range Rover, their luxury properties in Sandton, their clothes, as well as the EFF's fourth birthday bash.
Okay, so we've got an agreement here from Brian Shivambu to pay back about a quarter, nearly 5 million rand of the 20 million that went through his accounts. But he was also then the conduit for money, it would seem, to his brother and the leader of the EFF. Could he not be held liable for that money too, or is that another story to come?
Yes, indeed, he should. So the rest of the money went through to different companies, at least three that we know of at the moment, Robvet, Wegezi Power and Vele Investments. They are all VBS-linked companies. The loans were obviously VBS mutual bank loans. Now, Advocate Mittal found in his report, along with Dorfman Worksmans, that these cash and the companies all ensured that, or they worked along with VBS, to create a one concerted effort or a cartel to ensure that they fleeced the money from the depositors and funneled it right through to various beneficiaries, including the current politicians that is under question. Now, at least one loan has been paid back after VBS has demanded the money back. Now we're talking about Vele Investments and the curator and liquidation process there, and then the rest of the money should be recouped as well. But the recoupment of the money, the civil procedure, is very much different from the criminal procedure that the Hawks and the prosecuting authority should initiate.
Okay, so there's a parallel process. There's a civil procedure to get back the money. That is the prerogative then of the curator of VBS Mutual Bank. What do we know about the possibility of criminal prosecutions coming in terms of this money, which was funneled through Brian Shivambu's account?
Well, neither the Shivambus nor Malema has been asked questions or has been charged or has appeared before the prosecuting authority in a court. We know that 15 people have been arrested so far. One of them, obviously, the chair of Vele and VBS, Shafiwa Matotsi, who is the same person who sent messages to the treasurer relating to this account of Julius Malema and Floyd Shivambu, saying that it was a very strategic account, and later on saying that it should be paid money for lobbying fees. So we know how Shafiwa Matotsi in around 2017, 2018 viewed this account and what it was for. And now the Hawks and the prosecuting authorities should do their work. And the journalists and the rest of the country should ask these questions repeatedly.
Absolutely. I mean, the CFO, Philip Truta, he was the CFO of VBS Mutual Bank. He is entered into a plea bargain with the state. It's not like the state doesn't have enough evidence. It's not like they don't have any original sources when it comes to really uncovering the truth as to what has happened to this particular money. Have you tried to make contact with either Floyd Shivambu or Julius Malema recently? I know previously they've sent you all kinds of terrible threats. They've banned Daily Maverick from their events and all of these sorts of activities. But have you made contact with them on this latest development?
Yes, they received really good PR advice and they are trying to ignore any questions at the moment. That's where we are. They feel they banned us and they are also not answering any questions.
Thank you, Boley van Vaag, journalist with Scorpio at Daily Maverick. I see the editor of Daily Maverick, I'm assuming this is Branko Brickic, it could be somebody else, and the editor's seat, saying the EFF leaders have also, at very least, encouraged a massive social media misinformation campaign replete with threats against the Scorpio reporter, that'd be Boley. They've also banned Daily Maverick, Scorpio and Amabungani from reporting on their public events. They have not, however, gone the legal route for obvious reasons. That is the editor of Daily Maverick today. Yeah, that big story, an acknowledgement of debt signed by a branch of Ambu, and it was all done in confidence. But Polyfund Bank has a way of finding out the secrets and sharing those with us this evening here on The Money Show.
702.
SMS Bruce.
On 31702.
Toby Shapshak, the publisher of Stuff Magazine, is going to join us on Mondays to talk about technology and talk about big developments in the world of tech. But before we do that, tell me a tale about the late Shalene Surtee Richards, if you would, Toby.
That's such a... Hello, Bruce, firstly, and thanks for having me. It is the most historical story. I was backpacking on a thing, I don't know, 2022, and I was at the pyramids in Giza. I hadn't seen another South African apart from the person I was traveling with for months. And we'd been deep into like the giant pyramid of Giza. You know, you climb out of there, it takes you like half an hour to climb out, and it's dark, and you're surrounded by tens of thousands of tons of granite and rock. And I get out and I just hear this Afrikaans voice, flukking. Yada, fluk, yes, fluk, this bonker dark and it's granny dark. And he,
oh, lovely.
Like, fluk, don't you fluk, fluk. And I came out and I was like, no way. So, I mean, it's from the era where photographs were still printed on pieces of paper. I'm sure I've got a picture of us together somewhere. But, I mean, just what a legend. What a pity.
Yeah, absolutely. Really awesome. Somebody close to your own heart. Absolutely. Shalene Surtee Richards stuck in a pyramid with Toby Shapshak. No wonder she was swearing. Now, listen, TikTok is the thing that our children like. TikTok is for fun videos. TikTok is for playing the fool. Yet, TikTok for Business is being launched in this country this week, I think. TikTok for Business. I mean, what on earth is anybody thinking?
Well, here's the thing, Bruce. So WhatsApp has launched its business service. And if we think about it, lots of young people spend most of their time inside one app. If you're going to spend your time inside one app, shouldn't it be easier for you to say, hey, I like that shirt someone's wearing, or I like those shoes, let me just buy it. And that's where messaging apps are going. Instagram, WhatsApp, Tencent's WeChat has always been there. There's always been a functionality inside of that. And I'm sure you've seen very often, seemingly always with people interested in doTERRA, you message someone and suddenly it says, this is a business account. And that's what the very big controversial problem with Facebook's attempt to change the WhatsApp privacy conditions were earlier this year, that they wanted to integrate all of that information into their existing platform to let businesses sell directly to you. And WhatsApp, of course, has done it. WeChat have always done it. And now it's the turn of the new hot app on the block, TikTok. Now, TikTok is it was originally an app called music.lv, and you could record yourself, you know, if you're a teenager. I have three teenage nieces, so I've, you know, that became the thing du jour. You'd record yourself lip syncing to a song or dancing or doing something. And TikTok took that, the owner ByteDance, and they've just exploded. You know, there was this massive scandal with Donald Trump last year where TikTok users managed to spoof both Trump's administration and the Republican Party, thinking they'd sold a million tickets to his first post-COVID rally. And of course they hadn't, it was less than half full. So this is TikTok's play to start commercializing, to add e-commerce to their offering. And of course it's what everybody's doing, but it doesn't help that today there were very interesting stories coming out that TikTok in America has a set of terms and conditions that says it will record your voice print and your face print. It's pretty much like taking a copy of your fingerprints, and that they will have access to everybody who uses that. Now, I mean, that just immediately freaks me out. Like, why would they need that information? And why would they do it so surreptitiously? It's enough for me to, if I had a teenager of my own, to ban them. I don't know if it's possible to ban teenage nieces from doing anything, but it freaks me out that this is, in the world of surveillance capitalism, this is what companies are openly doing. They're openly asking to basically take a copy of your fingerprints in another form. It's biometric information.
I mean, so in 30 seconds or less, Toby, I mean, what does this mean then for TikTok for business? I mean, this is surely a security issue. You've really got to go in with your eyes wide open here.
Sadly, probably nothing, Bruce. Most kids are not going to care. Most people who are up in arms about the WhatsApp privacy terms and how it encroaches, they would have just said yes the next time the terms and conditions came up. I installed a new phone and I had no choice but to say yes. So TikTok, for the most part, has seemed quite benign. All of a sudden, it is a player in the surveillance capitalism world, and that freaks me out and scares me. You know, what is it about these companies that they can't just sell us an honest service without data mining us or trying to steal our face prints and our voice prints, you know, without affecting our permission? I mean, we don't know if this is going to happen, but when stories like this emerge, there's never smoke without fire. You know, maybe they should hire Digital Vibes to help them massage the message.
Very, very, very briefly, Apple have got a big announcement coming up this evening. What are you expecting?
Yes, it's actually their Worldwide Developer Conference, which is usually a software-related event. But there are suggestions that there'll be a new, usually where Apple announces the new operating systems. And it used to just be two. Now it's three for Mac OS, iPad OS, and iOS for iPhones. But there may be a new laptop. There may be some more stuff. We'll have more to talk about next week.
Toby Shabshak, publisher of Stuff Magazine.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show, brought to you by APSA Corporate Investment Banking, an award winner at Global Finance, The Innovators 2021. That's African Asset. APSA is a registered FSP. The chief executive of Tungela Resources is standing by. Chat to July Ndlovu in just a moment. So I want to share with you this terrible indictment on South Africa's crime levels and how a private company has had to develop its own strategy, its own plans to fight crime across its stores. In the same way as you have got a private security company that patrols your streets, and you may very well have a private security company that comes to your house. You may even have posted a guard at your gate in order to try and mitigate against the risk of violent crime. What ShopRite has done, not only has it taken a proactive approach to preventing crime happening against its stores, but it's also got very, very involved in building cases against perpetrators to raise the odds of them being convicted for crimes that they commit. And the strategy, it says, has been paying off. They've seen a 16% year-on-year decline in violent and serious crimes, including armed robberies and burglaries. That's between July last year and May this year. And of course, we see the unemployment numbers, we see massive inequality in society. South Africa is a place that is highly susceptible to crime, and particularly to violent crime. But it's extraordinary, and it really brings to home the extent of the problem, because what ShopRite has done, it's got itself involved in the entire process, from identifying suspects to getting their arrests secured, being in court to oppose bail, working with police to ensure that they've got a complete and accurate docket. I mean, essentially doubling up on police duties here. Working with the National Prosecuting Authority, providing evidence in court and doing everything they can to ensure that criminals are prosecuted. Because by then, the damage is done. Customers and staff are traumatized. I mean, you see some of the videos that happen where these enormous gangs of people move into supermarkets and start, you know, shooting out the ceilings and stuff to get people to be compliant. And people are freaked out completely by this, understandably so. But they're able to be more effective in terms of preventing crimes. They're getting better at getting business intelligence done. And as a net result, the investigation team has made 752 court appearances. This is just in the last year, including the desperately frustrating postponements, which, of course, are part and parcel of court activity in South Africa. If only we could be more efficient in terms of those postponements, but also to bail hearings, to testifying and to sentencing. And in the 11 months from July to May, they've secured 64% more guilty findings and convictions than the previous 12 months. That amounts to, they say, 303 years and 6 months of prison sentences and 46 years and 6 months of suspended sentences. So this, again, privatization of yet another aspect. This is public sector public sector. I suppose it's regular crime in South Africa, but with devastating consequences. Very, very expensive. And again, that goes on, the cost of fighting this crime, by the way, gets put onto you. Every can of baked beans you buy, every egg you buy, every item you buy is, as a, you know, it's got to have this cost added to it. It's absolutely devastating. It really is. The cost of crime in the South African economy is enormous.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, day one was a rough one for Thungela Resources, the coal business spun out of Anglo American. For every 10 shares in Anglo American you owned, you were given one Thungela share. It fell sharply on day one of trade. Many investors who'd received the shares sought to exit Thungela as a result of them wanting to get as far away from thermal coal as possible. Chief Executive at Thungela Resources is July Ndlovu on the line to us from Johannesburg this evening. You've had an up and down day, July, no doubt. What is the case for coal in a global environment that is very focused on issues of ESG, on environment, on society and on governance? Give me the case for coal, if you would.
Good evening, Bruce. The case for coal is that we have a commodity that the developing world is still needs, remains a key part of the energy mix, not just today, but for the foreseeable future. Clearly, as the transition that happens, what we will see is probably a different pace of transition depending on where you are on the globe. Our conviction certainly is that in the developing world, we're probably going to see a far slower transition because there is a significant need for coal. The energy infrastructure that is fossil fuel-based is still quite young, and it's unlikely to be decommissioned just yet. And that's why we're actually convicted that if you look at countries like China, India, Pakistan, Vietnam, Bangladesh, We think that demand is going to remain secure and robust for a period of time. Secondly,
the life of your current mines, though, is at best at around 10 years, which means you need to explore and you need money for development. And banks are not particularly keen on funding expansion of coal. How are you going to get around that?
That is only correct if you're looking at traditional sources of finance, Bruce. If you look in the Far East, which is where coal is still being banned, I firmly believe that, in fact, we should be able to find funding if we have got a good project. But clearly, in our case, we think we should be able to fund some of our low capex, short payback projects that we have got for life extensions from our own cash flows.
Okay, so you're confident that you will be able to raise money for future exploration. So even though your current asset base has got a life of 10 years, you see this as a long-term project, correct?
Correct, because I see demand being secure, at least for the next decade and a half for sure. Mm. There is uncertainty beyond that, but I think we're going to continue to burn coal for a while. So anyone writing an obituary for coal is probably acting too early.
What about the cost of cleaning up the environment? I mean, more and more we're seeing mining companies being held liable for the cleanup costs. And there is a group of short sellers, you would have seen them, they're all over the place today, called Boatman Capital. They're saying the cleanup bill that you've disclosed, that Anglo American disclosed, is inadequate. They're saying the real cleanup bill could be three times higher than you have disclosed. And that essentially renders this particular company worthless. What is your response to Boatman Capital?
Oh, you're referring to that deeply flawed and fake report. For a number of reasons, Bruce, I mean, firstly, the NEPA regulations that they purportedly have used to arrive at their conclusions are in draft and out for comment. And these are regulations that have been in discussion since 2015. They have not been promulgated for the simple reason that they are not workable in their current form. They do inflate what is required, despite the fact that, in fact, the actual rehabilitation required itself has not changed. Coming to us specifically, because that's the point you're making, we don't believe that, in fact, we've underprovided. We've provided in terms of IFRS requirements. These have been audited, and if you look at what we've provided on our balance sheet, $6.45 billion, compared to the minimum requirements of the law, which is $3.9 billion, actually we have gone beyond the norms that are required in the mining industry. So
let's look at beyond what is required. Let's look at beyond what the business case is for coal, and let's just look at it on a purely human basis. I mean, do you acknowledge that the world has got a pollution problem, and part of that pollution problem is as a result of fossil fuels, and part of that is as a result of coal? It's a dirty resource. It burns badly. It's very, very expensive to burn it more cleanly, and not everybody behaves in an ethical fashion when they burn the stuff. Do we not need to be weaning ourselves as a planet off coal as a resource? I know you'll make the argument that we have no choice right now because of the power stations that have been built, but surely the headwinds, the pressure that you face into the future is just going to get larger and larger. It's certainly not going to get smaller and smaller.
I make a slightly different argument, Bruce. And the argument I make is that there are cleaner coal technologies that can make coal cleaner. Yes, I make the argument that the developing world requires coal, but actually there's a far more compelling argument that says we've got to make coal cleaner because the pathway to an accelerated transition actually goes through coal. Why did I say that? If you think about building windmills and wind turbines, one of those requires 260 tons of iron ore, 170 tons of coking coal. Before you can build all this clean coal infrastructure, you're going to have to mine these metals that are required for the transition. Where is that? Where is the energy for mining those metals going to come from if it is not from current energy infrastructure? There are cleaner coal technologies, such as high-emission, low-emission technologies, that if we actually were focused on implementing today, we can burn coal cleaner.
July Ndlovu, thank you very much for chatting to us this evening. Chief Executive of Thungela Resources. I'm looking forward to seeing the performance of the share price. There are lots of investors at the beginning stage here, and it's natural that there's going to be a shakeout because not everybody wants to be part of the coal story. Certainly not in London, where there is a secondary listing of this company. But eventually, as our market commentator Sibonise Ngumalo from Old Mutual Investment Group put it, every asset has a value. Every business has a value. There is going to be demand into the future for thermal coal. We in South Africa will be dependent on thermal coal for the foreseeable future to burn to generate electricity. And you've got to have extraordinarily strong principles to say, no, 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 I'm willing to tolerate load shedding in perpetuity. You know, assuming we get Kusile and the other mess up and running in the not too distant future on some kind of reliable basis, because they were so badly built. But yeah, you know, do you have that level of conviction? And unless activists have got a particular level of conviction, but as an ordinary human being, do you have a level of conviction that says no, absolutely not? We should not be burning coal, not one further block of the stuff, because actually it's devastating long-term to the environment. Or do you buy July Ndlovu's assurances that we can clean up the mess it leaves behind?
The Money Show.
Business books.
Tonight's business book is called The Midlife Money Makeover. It is written by certified financial planner Kim Portgieter, who is a planner. I've lost my place. But anyway, Kim Portgieter, that's what's important. She is the author of Midlife Money Makeover. Very few people start investing nearly early enough to get the enormous power of compounding in their portfolios over long periods of time. Many people wake up to the fact that life is whizzing by quite late due to the fact they've got kids and mortgages and car payments. Look, it happens. This is the reality of the world. And suddenly they realize there's no safety net to catch them one day when they're unable to work. You've got other people who are just stressed out about the fact that one day they will stop working. And although they've been absolutely diligent and absolutely fastidious in their investing and saving journey, but they wonder how to make that transition from a midlife to an elder life. Kim Portgieter, certified financial planner and author of Midlife Money Makeover. I mean, we look at any statistic and it'll tell you that South Africans are dramatically underinvested for their retirements, Kim, and it's probably only getting worse.
Evening, Bruce. Yeah, that's quite a good fact that you've got there.
So how do we address the problem of underinvestment? Because for so many people, they wake up one day and they go, oh dear, I'm 40, I'm 45, I'm 50. Oh hell, it's too late. They might put their heads in the sand and try and pretend they can keep earning an income in perpetuity and that somehow one day it'll all be okay. Do you face a lot of that in your practice?
So, I mean, that's what I see and that's why I've written the book, because my whole thinking was, what I'm encouraging people to do is not dig their head in the sand, because every year longer that you put your head in the sand, it just makes it harder and harder for you to have the investments that can one day support you. So I wanted to write a book that actually was approachable, that people could feel that they could do it. So instead of running away, they face it head on.
And then, of course, the risk there is they might face it head on, but then they start, in many cases, people do silly things. They start, looking at options on the internet to try and make money faster. They try and outperform the market. They start getting a little bit too clever and perhaps taking a little bit too much risk. And I suppose that's then where the calm wisdom and the calm sage comes in and says, okay, calm down. Yes, you've messed it up, but we can sort of make the best of a bad situation here.
And Bruce, the whole thing on that is to get a plan. So most people don't know where they are. They don't know where they're going to. So I'm encouraging people just to pause and stop and just take stock of where are they actually. And then you can put a plan in action instead of just carrying on. I call it on the hamster wheel. It's time just to take a step out and reflect on what's going on and actually have some truthful conversations with yourself and your partner.
And those are often very hard because, maybe one partner had kind of left it up to the other one to say, you look after the finances, I'll do X, you do Y. And everybody kind of is living in the joyful ignorance of, the annual big holidays and the nice cars and the private schools and all of these things, because people are living beyond their means. They are living a life that actually they can't afford. And I think for many, many South Africans, particularly high-earning households in South Africa, people kind of think, I deserve this. I'm keeping up with the Kumalos, or I'm keeping up with the Joneses, or whoever you're trying to keep up with. And they find that it's very, very hard to then manage lifestyle down when it comes to that brutal reality that they've been living beyond their means for a long period of time.
And Bruce, COVID's compounded that.
Yep.
So with what we've all been going through, and that's why I actually, while I was writing the book and going through COVID, I put an extra chapter in the book around it, because that's the reality of what we're all facing, is some people's whole planning it hasn't happened the way they thought it was going to happen. Some people have lost jobs. Some people have gone into half their salaries, but their expenses haven't changed. And the whole success to the financial plan is if you are living above your means, you're not actually able to invest anything, and then there isn't anything for later.
And the consequences of that, of course, are, you are the one who ends up suffering. Nobody else suffers as a result of this. And that, I think, is the brutal reality people wake up to. I mean, when people come to you in their 40s and 50s and they say to you, Kim, I think we may have a problem here. How are you able to sort of help them through that without giving away all of the secrets in the book, of course? But the point is, I think there's hope at every life stage to at least make things better than they might otherwise have been.
Well, Bruce, the first place to start, and that's the place that I start with every client, is for them to realize that they are actually their greatest asset. And when they can understand that, and they understand that, they're going to need to work longer, because if you haven't taken care of it well enough, your finances, you have to work longer. So best you upskill yourself, find work that you want to be doing so that you can do it a lot longer. And then also it's looking at your relationship with money and working out what money actually represents to you and what money says about you. And as you said, if we're worrying about keeping up with everybody else, one day that the other people don't care where we are. So it's really important for you to work on what's important to you, what your values are, and stop worrying about everybody else and what everybody else is doing. And just really come a little bit about what your family needs and what's best going to serve you.
And you can have a perfectly good plan. And you can have a very good view as to what you're doing. But then things go wrong. I mean, the death and divorce and the troublesome families and things fall apart quite spectacularly. I mean, life goes horribly wrong. COVID is part of that problem, in addition to all of these things I've mentioned. And, you know, nobody can possibly plan for the disasters that sort of lurk in the wings, and we hope and we pray that these things don't happen to us, but you know, that's not a strategy. You have to be able to have a sense of financial fortitude should things go wrong in your life.
So it's going to happen. That is a certainty that not everything's going to go according to your plan. But I still find by having a plan, at least when these uncertainties happen, you have emergency funds, you have insurance, you have money that you can fall back on. So vital is that you have that. One of the reflections that I have a whole lot of midlife reflections in the book, is on your timeline. And if any of us drew our timeline, if we're in our 50s or in our late 40s, we will have had times where things had gone wrong. But invariably, if we have the right attitude and we put the right things in place, when we come out of where it goes wrong, we're often better off. So it's good to reflect back and see that, but also to see that how your plan could then kick into action when things weren't going according to schedule.
What I love about the book is not that it's another personal finance book, because there are lots of personal finance books, but you're very cleverly targeted a crisis point in many people's lives. And it's that midlife realization that I think most people will come to at some point going, oh dear. Or use another word, perhaps a little stronger. But what you've come up with is also this idea of the midlife money makeover journal. And this is the sort of a tool to help people through the uncertainty. And you designed it to accompany the book, but I think you could, you know, sort of use it separately as well, almost as a record of your hopes, fears, aspirations, and your plan to get out of the mess that you're in.
So Bruce said two things on that. I never wanted anybody to read the book and then said, oh, I read the book. It's not a theory book. It's really a book that you're going to put into practice, hence why I wanted there to be a journal, because you need to do this work. It is a journey. And also I wanted, if you're in a relationship, I wanted both parties to do it. Because as you mentioned earlier, often we'll say, you know, you take care of the finances and I'll take care of the children or whatever. And at this time, I think it is so vitally important that you both get involved and you both get engaged. That what I want that people to do is to read the book and each do their own journals. And then if you're in a partnership, to read each other's, just so that you can see where that one person is at and how you can work together going forward. It's so important.
Kim Paul-Gieter, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Kim is a certified financial planner. She is also the author of Midlife Money Makeover, not only of the book, but of the journal as well. The journal is a very clever addition to this because it requires you. And if you're averse to doing a bit of work on your money, then this is not the book for you. But if you are serious about taking steps and action to avoid a calamity later on in life, then I could only recommend it. As I do many other personal finance books, because we are spoiled for choice in South Africa with lots and lots of really, really good personal finance books. This is one of the really good, more recent ones, your Midlife Money Makeover.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
Tapping your feet, I don't know where you live. I don't know what's happened to you. Rocco de Villiers, that's him, by the way. He's a South African pianist, a producer, a composer, a musical director, and apparently a cocktail connoisseur. If there's time, we'll talk about cocktails. Rocco de Villiers, were you a kid who had to be dragged to music lessons, or did you go voluntarily?
I started playing piano. Actually, I was bored, so I was told by my family. So I asked the fantastic man who was looking after me when I was a little boy to break the lock of the piano, and that's how I started playing. But it took a while before my mom realized that, you know, she thought this child must maybe start to get proper lessons, and that's how it started. I was about 4 years old, so I wasn't never dragged. My parents never told me to practice, do my scales, nothing of the sort. They just left me, and actually my piano teacher also, she never asked me to do anything. I did it myself and then presented her with a piece every Monday morning at 9:40. I had my piano lesson at school.
So many kids are kicked dragging, kicking and screaming. There we go. I'll get my words together. Drag, kicking and screaming to music lessons. They're forced to do music. They're forced to do music because their parents wish they'd done music. Is there an argument to be made for kids to be encouraged ferociously to do music lessons?
I think the word encourage is the right way to go. I think every child in the world must have some other music lesson, whether it's guitar, piano, singing, because I think it works on your fantasy world. You learn to think about other things. And I think it should be like sport, but it doesn't work that in real life. But I think having a talent for music or art or any part of the art world, it's when you see that in a child, you must sort of help them, but never force. Because, you know, when I was at school, a lot of children were dragged, like you said, to piano lessons. And then there were these terrible teachers who used to hit them over the knuckles.
That was then. That was then. It was a different time. I don't think it beaten still. I hope not.
No. With the ruler, and that will kill. You know, if that happened to me, I won't even listen to music, let alone play. So I think it's important to recognize talent in a child, but never force them to do that. You know, you don't have to play piano, but if you can do it for a couple of years, that's a good thing.
Are you mathematically inclined? There's a theory, a strong theory, and I think quite a plausible theory, that much of music is mathematics, much of mathematics is music, and the patterns are similar, and were you good at maths?
Yes, I was. I had 3 A's in matric. I was Afrikaans, and mathematics and music. So, and I think music is like maths and the other way around, especially when you listen to the music of Bach, of Johann Sebastian Bach. It is literally like, but all music, you know, the meat of it, 4/4 or 3/4, it's exactly like maths.
Okay, well, then, thank you for confirming the theory. Talk to me about money. Did Rocco grow up in a house that had resources, had good money?
Absolutely not. My dad worked for the municipality.
Which municipality was this? Which place? Where did you grow up?
In the Free State. I grew up in Harry Smith.
In Harry Smith. Gotcha.
Eastern Free State. Very cold. It's the second coldest town in South Africa. So my dad worked for the municipality, and we were middle class, middle everything, Dutch reform people who went to church every Sunday morning, gave our tenth, and from month to month, we calculated our money, and that's how we lived. And that is what I was taught about money. You work, and then you get something, and then you use it for whatever you need, and then you wait for another month, and you work again. So I was never taught about investment and those kind of things.
I mean, going to do a music degree, in many cases, getting a music degree gets you incredibly well qualified to teach small children who don't want to learn to play music. You, however, have commercialized your musical degree and your musical experience in a way that very, very few people in South Africa have. I mean, you became musical director at Club 58. It was apparently, I don't know if it still exists, but a cabaret venue in Hillbrow, that was in the early 1990s. And since then, you've become really well known as a standalone musician. You've traveled, you've toured, you play really good, heartfelt, upbeat music. You're sort of Elton John-ish in your performance. I mean, you like the drama of the music. You like to show off a little bit when you play.
I don't know about show off. I like the package. I think even when I studied music, I didn't really fit in with the other classical musicians, because I already then, when I was 18, 19, had a sense that I want to present not only the music, but also the lights, my costume, what I have to say about the music, maybe have something in front to sell. I always had that kind of entrepreneurial a world in mind. But that is never taught when you study music. You know, before the pandemic, I was asked to do a couple of talks all over South Africa at music schools. I was heavily criticized for what I said, because my opening line was, it's as important to learn how to write out an invoice as it is to learn your scales. And I wish someone told that when I was a student, because I learned that very, very, very late in my career. Too late. Because when you write out an invoice, doesn't matter how good or bad you are, you put a value to what you do. And also, you realize what you are worth. So, but I always like the drama, yes, of course. I'm not saying, I'm not the Elton John. I think if you really want to earn more in the direction of Liberace.
I was going there. That was next. I mean, I don't know what it is about piano players. I mean, it's a beautiful instrument and you can be truly dramatic on it, but there has to be extra flair added to the playing of the piano. But what was so offensive to these music schools that you were pointing out the harsh and brutal realities of life? Were you undermining the art? Were you commercializing? Surely you want your musicians to be as successful as they possibly can be. It can only be good for the advancement and the people wanting to play music.
You know, I think it's slowly changing, but there will always be a part of the art world and the music world who when you get money for it, you're not a real artist. I don't understand that, because you have to suffer for your art, or you have to be poor. You have to be suffer your whole life, and then when you're dead, then they can say how fantastic you are, but he only had 1 year or whatever. Is I don't want to be like that. You know, I don't want to one day dying in a newspaper say, oh, he wanted to have fun but never had fun. Or he was extremely talented but lived in a garage. I'm not like that, and I was never like that. And I also like nice things too much. So
I want to talk about those nice things in a moment, because you've been very commercially successful. We'll talk a bit about lockdown and how tough that's been, because you're not only a player of music, you also are a producer of stage productions, of course, your own stage productions. You also are the co-owner and co-director of Third Ear Sound with Kutlwano Masorte, who's well known in Joburg music circles as well. And I mean, you have many strings to your bow, literally. But as a piano player, of course, our guest this evening is Rocco de Villiers, the pianist, the composer, the musical director, talking about the benefits of music, of course, the mathematics of music, and commercializing that music, and then some expensive tastes. I can't wait. More in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. This year's winners of Global Finance, Most Innovative Bank in Africa, the Innovators Awards 2021. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
Years from now, hopefully when we're through COVID-19 and we've got vaccinations and everybody is vaccinated and we've gone back to going to concerts and festivals and having fun, 2020, 2021, possibly 2022 will be remembered as an era where the fun died. It really did. There's been so little fun, at least outside the home anyway. How's your lockdown been, Rocco? I mean, have you managed to keep busy? Have you managed to keep commercially active during this time?
Oh, I don't know where to start with this. Okay. I try to, from the beginning, to do what one can to keep your profile out there, and that, of course, started with online shows. But online shows died very quickly because I think, and I don't want to criticize my colleagues, but I think a lot of people presented online shows of bad quality. You know, if you lie in your bed and you stream a show from via your cell phone, I can't do that. And a lot of artists did those shows for free, and then there was a barcode at the bottom of the screen, and then you could donate money. I didn't want to do that because, as I said earlier, I know what the value of my work is. So all my online shows were produced properly. We shot it with four cameras, and I asked a fee like I would have asked if you come to see my show. You go to CompuTicket and you buy a ticket. In fact, I use CompuTicket for all my... But unfortunately, the online show thing didn't carry on very long. But by then, we could do shows again. And you know what? I think it was level three, I could do shows for 50 people. And I will never forget, my assistant one Wednesday morning said to me, we have so many small towns in South Africa asking, will you please come and do a show for them? What do you want to do? And I sat down and I calculated and I thought, if I can do 80 shows for 50 people that can pay some money and I make them happy, and I know that I cement that fan base so that when we get back into the real world and we can entertain in a proper way again, I know those people will come back. So that is what I did. And I just have to say, I have so much respect and I take my hat off for someone like Sibongile Ngoma, who at the Artscape offices sat down and said, we have to get more people into theatres. You have to change this. I think it was a fantastic idea to do that. But I tend to do things. I think, on Saturday I did a show again for 100 people in Pretoria. And I just think if 400 seater people, it would have been sold out for 400 people. All that I do now is I do four shows. 400 people. Yeah. I pass out afterwards because I'm tired because I've done that show four times. But I think that is what I have to do for now, and it will get better. You know, there's a virus. It will pass. It will get better.
You've got to preserve the brand. You've got to preserve brand integrity, and you've got to keep your fans reminding your fans that you exist and that you are there for them. Because right now, what you're doing is not for you; it's for them. You're giving, and hopefully, you're covering your costs, and you're able to keep moving and keep going. You talked about having expensive tastes earlier. This is my favorite bit. I like small Inanna skeletons. I like finding out what people who are household names like to spend their money on. If let's assume we're post-COVID and your bank balance is restored and your debt is paid down and you're back to sort of pre-COVID concert levels and everybody's having a jol again, what are you looking forward to spending money on again?
On air ticket to New York. And then...
is that your favorite city on earth? What do you like about it?
Yes, I like New York because I like cities. That's why I also like Hong Kong, international cities where everything is available 24/7. I like that idea of a city where it's up to the consumer to decide what he or she wants whenever they want it. I want to go to New York when it's all over. Then I want to have a list of my 10 favorite bars from the Bemelman top of the standard. And I want to consume as much Cosmopolitans as my body can possibly take. And then I want to sit with my friends and go to nice restaurants and museums. And maybe if I can go to as many shows on Broadway.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just the good life. I mean, do Cosmopolitans differ? You talk about going to your 10 favorite bars. You described in your write-up as a cocktail connoisseur, somebody who is a fan of the cocktail. Is a Cosmopolitan a Cosmopolitan is a Cosmopolitan, or are there subtleties in...
No, it's like a whiskey. It's not a single malt. Cosmo is a very old-fashioned drink. You know, it's one of the first drinks that sort of came from the in America when they had the prohibition.
What's the basic recipe?
Vodka, cranberry juice, real lime juice, and Cointreau. And it's a pinkish drink. And for the listeners who were fans of Sex and the City, that was their favorite drink.
But they differ. So it's all to do with the mixology. It's all to do with the art. It's also, I'm sure, to do with the atmosphere of the particular bar that you're in at any one time that will affect the experience of having the Cosmo, for goodness sake.
And the size of the glass.
So, I mean, the thing is, you're not averse to living the good life. Do you invest money, or are we going to have to refer you to Kim Potgieter, our guest at 7:15 in the Midlife Money Makeover, or will you be okay to have Cosmos until you can't sip anymore?
I think there's a fine balance with that, but I just have to go back a couple of steps. When you mentioned Club 58, where I worked when I came to Johannesburg, that was 1989. And I remember I worked for 400 rand a week. That was my salary. And after the second month, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to end up like my father who worked from week to week or month to month. I have to do something about this. And a man called Chris Seabrook came to the club one night. And he said to me, you're going to become very famous, but you have to try and do something with the money. You know, the track record of pianists, apart from Liberace and Richard Clayderman, isn't very good when it comes to money. And it sort of stuck in my head, but then I couldn't do anything because I didn't have any money. And I remember I took my second paycheck and I didn't eat for a week, and I had a proper photo shoot done by Adele Hamlin because I knew the photo shoot will enable me, because then a proper photograph was like a business card. You know, that would enable me to do other things so that I can make more money. And then I realized, but if I produce my own stuff, and then I can make more money, and then I can invest that. But the investment and the idea of it came very, very late in my life because I didn't understand. Remember, I was from that family that I told you.
Yeah, exactly. It's the point. But Chris Seabrook, I mean, did you keep in touch with Chris Seabrook? Because Chris Seabrook, of course, one of the wealthiest people in South Africa, the founder of SabVest. I mean, are you invested in his funds?
No, I didn't. But he gave me some tips. Whether they worked is a whole other story. But I was never taught about investment. You know, there was no guidance. But in a way, the lack of guidance that I had when I was a little boy sort of taught me to do other things and not. Yeah. I like luxury because you asked me about luxury, but I also don't. You know, at one stage I did a very big job.
Rocco, the time.
20 years ago, I did a very big job and I bought a Mercedes.
Are you still driving it?
And I I sold it to buy a brand new concert grand. That is what you call investment in your career.
And well, that's it. You're investing in your tools of the trade. Rocco de Villiers, I wish we had more time. We never have enough time. Rocco de Villiers, Other People's Money, composer, pianist, musical director, fabulous guest this evening, and also somebody who should have listened a bit more closely to Chris Seabrook a little earlier. Thank you, Rocco de Villiers.